This is our third Sunday doing the parables of Jesus, but the weather's been so horrible. I know that not everyone's been here for both the two previous ones, so I do want to give just a little bit of background to what we're doing today. We're going to start with this morning. We'll pick up where we left off last week with the parable of the groomsmen in Mark chapter 2. We said that first session in this series, we mentioned that a parable is an illustration, a story that Jesus will tell. It literally means lay alongside or set alongside. He'll teach something and he'll tell a parable, sometimes to illustrate it. We've also seen that sometimes he just tells parables and doesn't interpret them, because one purpose of parables around about the middle of his ministry was to keep those who didn't really want to follow him from understanding. We saw it with a parable of the sower. If anyone wanted to know what a parable meant, they could always inquire and ask Jesus and follow him, and he'd interpret it for you. But by the time Jesus begins telling the majority of his parables, the people of Israel had kind of rejected him anyway, so he was just going to speak to them in riddles. They would have to come closer to figure out what they meant. We started with the parable of the sower because it's the one that he says, hey, if you don't get this one, you're not going to get any of the other ones. So we looked at that one. Hopefully you all got it. Now we're going back in time. He tells that parable about a year into his ministry. The parables that we're going to look at today, he tells much earlier on. And he doesn't give much of an explanation about them either, though. He totally doesn't give a great interpretation to the people who are listening to him. Let me go ahead and read. This is compared to Mark chapter 2, verses 18 through 22. Oh, no. Is it? Yeah, 22. I'll go ahead and read, and then we'll dive in. Now, John's disciples and the Pharisees were fasting, and the people came and said to him, why did John's disciples and the disciples of the Pharisees fast, but your disciples do not fast? And Jesus said to them, can the wedding guest fast while the bridegroom is with them? As long as they have the bridegroom with them, they cannot fast. The days will come when the bridegroom is taken away from them, and then they will fast in that day. No one sews a piece of unshrunk cloth on an old garment. If he does, the patch tears away from it, and the new from the old, and the tear is made worse. And no one puts new wine into old wineskins. If he does, the wine will burst the skins, and the wine is destroyed, and so are the skins. But the new wine is for fresh wineskins. Okay, so we talked also last week about the context for these particular parables. In the Old Testament, there's only one day that you're required as a Jew to fast. Anyone remember what that day is?
Day of Atonement,
right, yeah. That one day you don't eat anything. But there's no requirement that you fast any other day of the week. It's a voluntary thing. Sometimes you'd fast by taking a Nazarite vow, and that would be a fast from any wine or great products. But you could also fast as a sign of repentance, of mourning for your sin or sorrow for a loss of some kind. So there were definitely reasons to fast. Fasting for that purpose would be to say, to bring home to your physical body the reality that you have to be, you lean on and depend on God for everything. But by the first century, the Pharisees had adopted a two fast a week system. Right? If you were a Pharisee, you fasted on Monday and you fasted on Thursday. And don't know the severity of those fasts. Was it for no water and no food, or was it just a light diet? Who knows? But I kind of think it was a pretty severe one. The two days, Monday and Thursday. It looks like John's disciples from this text have gone along with them, and they're sharing in that fast. Maybe John's disciples do it for different reasons than the Pharisees do. The Pharisees have their their understanding of the law. They built up their traditions in addition to the law. John's disciples, I don't know about them, but they might be adopting this practice as a sign of repentance. Remember, John preached and did and gave a baptism for repentance. Now, I'm not going to spend a lot of time on the first three questions because we did talk about them last week. But you'll notice that first question there, the question in the text. John's disciples and the Pharisees were fasting, and the people came to him and said, "Hey, why do John's disciples and the disciples of the Pharisees fast, but your disciples do not fast?" Now, the question is posed as a request for information. What do you think? What could be the subtext to that question?
You know, you're supposed to be this holy guy, and these other holy guys do all this fasting, and you know, you're not doing it.
Yeah. We talked about the Pharisees' traditions became more than traditions. They became things you had to do, and we always got to be careful about this in the church and in the religious realm. It's very easy to take our own habits, our own ways of doing things, and assuming that they're not just good things for us to do voluntarily, but they're things that everybody has to do. Like, we're coming up on Lent, and so some people take on fasting disciplines of some kind during Lent. But we wouldn't want to say, you better fast during Lent or else you're sinning, because the Bible doesn't say that everyone has to fast during Lent. That we can only impose as a law what God has imposed as a law. We can't make up our own laws and impose them on people. So that's what the Pharisees are doing here. And one function of these things was not only, and I'm sure some of them were doing them sincerely, not only to draw close to God and to have a deeper sense of relationship with him, but they're also to show off, right? Jesus says this very clearly. You guys like to wear your long robes and take the best seats in the synagogue so that people will see how holy you are, and you like to tithe your mint and your cumin and all the other stuff. But those are all, he says, a lot of those are just things that you do on the outside to get people to think that you're holy, while on the inside you're not holy. You're full of dead men's bones. And that's also something we've got to be careful for, especially in a liturgical church, because we can use outward, external things that we do, like crossing ourselves if you cross yourself, or whatever, all the bowing and the scraping. Those can become external signs where you set yourself off as a more holy person than other people are. Don't want to do that. The Pharisees were experts at that. They had PhDs in this kind of thing. And so probably underlying this question is an accusation too. Like, why aren't you fasting like they are? And we said last week that there are all kinds of outward signs in our culture too that people wonder about. I mentioned the Seinfeld episode where Seinfeld had that, where Kramer went on the AIDS march, and to, as he was registering for the march, they said, well, here's a ribbon. You got to wear the AIDS ribbon. And Kramer says, well, I don't want to wear the AIDS ribbon. And they said, well, you have to wear the AIDS ribbon. And they said, well, I don't want to wear the AIDS ribbon. Don't you care about AIDS? Well, yeah, I'm here at the march. Well, no, you got to wear the ribbon. So it became this thing where ultimately Kramer was being beaten up in the alley because he wouldn't wear the ribbon. When obviously he cared about the AIDS thing, or he wouldn't have been at the march. So that was a great example of the way these kinds of outward signs function. And if we think about it just for a second, I'm sure we think of a lot of those outward visible signs of virtue, signals of virtue, that we're asked to put on or to say so that people will think we're culturally acceptable and righteous. Well, don't do it, or at least not for those reasons. Let's go ahead, and that's a summary of everything we talked about last week, at least in this parable. So let's go to that next section. So Jesus said to them, "Can the wedding guests fast while the bridegroom is with them? As long as they have the bridegroom with them, they cannot fast. The days will come when the bridegroom is taken away from them, and then they will fast in that day." So this culturally is Jesus is calling everyone's minds to a wedding feast. And our wedding feasts last about 3 or 4 hours. After the wedding, we go to the reception. That's the wedding feast, and then we go home. But even in our day, it wouldn't be appropriate to fast at a wedding feast. If you're sitting there with just a piece of bread or something on your plate, and someone says, "What are you doing?" I'm fasting. I'm only going to have bread and water. You know, it's a wedding. You're still beginning it kind of inappropriate to do that, because you're supposed to be celebrating. It's a party. You're supposed to be having a good time. Back then, we said this before, especially if you're wealthy, a wedding feast would last 7 days. And nobody would dream of fasting during a wedding feast because it would be an insult to the family, insult to the groom, insult to the bride, insult to everybody else. So you just wouldn't do it. And if you did, it'd be really weird. It'd be like you're definitely wanting to stand out and let people look at you. So Jesus uses the wedding feast to answer this question about why his disciples aren't fasting. What does that tell you about what time Jesus thinks it is, speaking not of a clock, but of redemption history? What time does Jesus think it is? And of course, he's right, compared to the others. Yeah, time.
Being closer to his death.
Well, it is closer to his death. But I mean, I guess, what are we waiting for? What's the next thing on the agenda of redemption for us?
The second coming.
Yeah, Jesus coming back, right? What are they waiting for?
Him to show up.
For Christ to show up, right? And so in our season of waiting, what's our season of waiting in the liturgical calendar? What's the season of waiting we have?
Advent.
Yeah, we're waiting. And so in Advent, if some people call it a little mini Lent, because you can take on a discipline in Advent, waiting for the coming of Christ, and many people do. Advent is a little bit like what Israel, most Israelites thought they were in. They thought they were in the waiting period. When will the Christ come? That's what time they thought it was. What time does Jesus think it is?
I'm here, right?
This is, by using the wedding feast as his picture here, he's saying, no, you guys have the wrong, you're on the wrong schedule. You haven't gotten the news that it's time for the feast, not the fast. Yes.
Would it be reasonable to think that Jesus probably wasn't the first person to come along and proclaim himself Christ? Like, I don't know. I'm trying to be somewhat sympathetic toward the Pharisees who are like, oh, like, you know, are they? Is this really something of a novel experience for them? I understand it is the miracles, but is this not the first time that they've seen someone be like, oh, look, here's somebody else calling themselves Christ again?
No, you're right. I mean, that's
reasonable to think.
That's totally, not only is it reasonable, it's factual. There have been other people coming along and saying they're the Christ too, and that will happen after Jesus as well. That is definitely a thing to keep in mind when you're assessing people's doubts about Jesus. Although I would say none of them did the things that Jesus does, right? There's other things aside from Jesus claiming it that would serve to substantiate his claim to be who he is. So, I mean, I think if you say, hey, this is a feast, not a fast, and you're just gathering an army, I guess, to overthrow the Romans, okay. But if you're also, like, raising the dead and feeding people out of nothing, all those kinds of miracles would indicate something is happening in redemption history Did you have your hand up?
I was just going to say, I love Jesus Christ Superstar, the original, don't watch the new one that's going to come out. That's stupid. Black people are going to play Jesus, whatever. But there's a song Pontius Pilate saying, you know, why does this man upset you? You Jews produce messiahs by the dozen.
Oh, yeah, okay, yeah, yeah. So that was the case. Everyone's waiting for that to happen. But again, this picture of the wedding feast says it's happened. I'm here. And we've already talked about what it would mean to fast as a wedding guest. If or since it's true that Jesus is the Christ, then all the things that were associated with the waiting period for the Christ to come, those are all subject to, they can be left aside. Just like you don't have to, If you make it to the city, if you're on a trip, and you have your, what do you call it, the thing that tracks how far it's going to be till you get to your city. What's it called? You have your GPS on, right? You get to the city, you get to your destination, you can push the end route. You don't have to be looking at your GPS anymore. Same thing. the crisis come, there's no more need for the things you needed on the road. It's done. Now, of course, identifying who's who in this parable is pretty easy. Who's the bridegroom?
Jesus.
Jesus is the bridegroom, right. But what are the implications of that figure itself? Jesus calling himself the bridegroom. That has some pretty dramatic implications. If you're an Old Testament person, you're thinking about Old Testament stuff, and some guy who claims he's a Messiah comes around and says, yeah, it's like a bridegroom at a wedding. You can't fast when the bridegroom's here. What would you think if you knew your Old Testament well? Maybe you don't. I've only preached on this 25,000 times, so I feel in the Old Testament, the bride is Israel, the groom is Yahweh, it's God. If you go through and look, there's no place that imagery is not the Christ and his bride. It's not just New Testament imagery. Yahweh is the husband of Israel. And when you see the husband-wife language in the Old Testament, it's always God who is the groom. It's never like the king or it's God. So for Jesus here to use this parable, not only says, well, you guys got your clocks mixed up, it's redemption time, I'm here, but also it challenges the Jewish people think the Messiah is going to be. They all think he's going to be a man. They think he's going to be the king, the descendant of David. But this, if you're just a human king, the descendant of David, however great that is, it's just dicey. It's really risky to use an image like this to speak about yourself, because you set yourself into God's into the God category. And if people are paying attention, they're going to be offended. They're going to be little question marks, red flags are going to be raised up in their heads as you're doing that. So Jesus is laying out a picture of God Himself coming to the great banquet, and He's inviting all of His people to be there with Him. So yeah, of course you wouldn't you don't need those old restrictions for the new times that are upon us. Although Jesus does, there is some shadow here in the feast. What do you think that he refers to when he says the day will come, or the days will come, and the bridegroom is taken away?
That's his crucifixion, obviously.
Obviously, we know that. Now,
they wouldn't know that.
Yeah, I mean, they'd still be thinking in terms of wedding feasts, and while you wouldn't fast while the groom is with you, because you're in that 7-day feast. After a 7-day feast, you might want to fast. You might say, I've gained a few pounds here over the last several days. I'm not going to eat for a while. But you wouldn't do it while he's there. Although the language in this, especially in Mark's version of this parable, indicates a kind of violent being taken away. Not just the bridegroom leaves, or that he's escorted to his throne or something. It's more of a rip, that when the bridegroom is ripped away, then you'll fast. Yeah.
Would they have seen that as talking about death, though, at the time?
Maybe not. We automatically know what this is because we're used to the crucifixion. I don't think they'd be tracking in the way that we are. Yeah. But it is interesting when he says, when the bridegroom is taken away, that's when people will be fasting. Are we living in the days when the bridegroom has been taken away?
No, he came back.
Yeah, he came back. There's a variety of answers to this. Some of them are in conflict with each other, but I'll lay some out depending on where you stand on things. You could say yes, he's been taken away. He's up in heaven. He's ascended into heaven. So what Jesus is saying here is an indication that Christians should engage regularly in fasting. Others will say, well, yeah, he went away, but he came back. So he's still here. We have the Holy Spirit. He's with us every Sunday in the church. We have the resurrection. So, I mean, this is not saying that Christians must engage in fasts. What do you think?
think he came back. So I'm like, you know, I'm saying, we're not, you know, I mean, yeah. I can see where the disciples, they really were very upset when he died until he came back and gave them hope in what came back. So that definitely was a period of fasting
right.
and mourning.
So you want to locate the fasting period in the Good Friday period in the...
But I think there's multiple layers. I mean, personally, you're kind of, if you don't know Jesus, you're not... I mean, like a spiritual fast. You know, you're spiritual desert if you don't know him, so you're not full of good things and being fed.
Right. Well, I think, I mean, I think we can probably... Oh, did you have a...
I was going to say... It seems like there's a lot of longing in the New Testament for the second coming. And I don't think that, I think that's compatible with the idea that at least an element of that is deserved. So,
yeah, I think
while there's, while the comforters here are still looking forward, and there's lots to pass about.
I think you're right. I think I tend to take the both and approach that. Yes, you're not required to fast, but yes, it's appropriate to fast if you, because we're in that time where it's we are still waiting for the final consummation. Yes.
I would use the rule that's supreme as like fasting in universal spiritual discipline. Like you see it present across many different religions, and even like I feel like beyond like organized religion, like you know you feel like you just kind of see it crop up and. Like, there's a reason why it's a tool. And, you know, you wouldn't use a screwdriver to, you know, hammer in a nail. But it is a tool, and I think that a Christian can discern appropriate periods of fasting for oneself.
No, I think that's a great point. It does cut across different faith traditions. I mean, it's a basic human thing. And I think it's a... Like I said, since I take the both and view, I think it's a thing of freedom. And because I think it's a thing of freedom doesn't mean I think you should just throw it over altogether. I think you should seriously consider how a fast might help you, like putting away food for a day or putting away drink for a day or whatever it might be, and using that time to feed on Christ with your reading, your prayer, all of that. One way our liturgy, I think, helps us see this kind of middle road that we're in. Even during Lent, if you decided you're going to give up, please don't do this. But if you decide you're going to give up chocolate, which is fine, but if that's your Lenten fast, then on Sunday you should eat chocolate. You should have a whole bunch of chocolate because that's the day we celebrate the resurrection. You can take a break from whatever fast that you're in, unless, like I said before, unless you're fasting from some kind of sin, then you don't. Sunday is not your free sin day, but you can give up whatever other fast you have going. All right, so good stuff. Number 21 there, verse 21. No one sews a piece of unshrunk cloth on an old garment. If he does, the patch tears away from it, and the new from the old, and the tear is made. A worse tear is made. This little parable also helps us understand the point that he's made in the previous one. In the previous one, the point was, one of the points was, you guys are operating on the wrong scale of time. You don't know what time it is in redemption history. This says the same thing in a different picture. What does the unshrunk cloth represent? The old garment, I guess. I'm sorry. Not the old garment. What does the unshrunk cloth represent, you think, in the parable?
I'm not sure, but it's two things that aren't matching up.
That's right. There's two things that are not matching up. Good to see.
They're not in the same state.
And you join them together. You try to do one. You try to put one on the other. What happens?
It doesn't work.
Yeah, it doesn't work because the whole thing, the fabric is torn. So the old garment, it's already been washed, it's been washed in the dryer a lot, it's shrunk, but the new one, the new patch, hasn't been through any of that. So you put it on, and then the first time you wash it, you're going to have the patch is going to start tearing away from the old garment. That's the idea. Yes?
Well, this is not very exegetical, because I'm basically reading my theology into the text. I guess the new cloth unshrunk cloth could be the new covenant, or what Jesus is bringing in the new covenant.
I don't think that's just your own theology. I think that's really what Jesus is trying to say. It's a new time now. I'm the bringer of the covenant that you heard about from Jeremiah in Jeremiah 33, when God's going to figure His law in your heart. There's a new time. He's going to pardon all of your sins. I think Jesus knows Himself to be that person, the bringer of the covenant. And so, yeah, that would signal the things associated with the old covenant law can begin to go away. Not because they were wrong or because they were bad. We've got to be careful about that. Those Old Testament laws, even the dietary ones, which we think are weird, were good laws. They were given by God. But those were for a time, and now they're no longer necessary, and so you can let them go. This will be fleshed out. I mean, we're reading it. We're in Acts right now, and we're seeing how hard that is for even believers in Jesus Jewish believers in Jesus to understand how that fleshes out. So that the Gentiles can come in without being circumcised. The Gentiles can come in without keeping our dietary restrictions. How does that work? It's not that we have to give them up, but just shouldn't the Gentiles be made to do them? So this is a question. What Jesus begins to do here is open up, I don't want to say conversation, but open up a new way of thinking about what's happened that continues to be debated and conversed about and fought over all the way through the first century. And Paul. So yeah, I think you're right. Any other thoughts about what this is?
I have a question. What is the analogy to a worse tear is made?
Well, it's because it's in a... The idea is it doesn't fit, right? It's inappropriate. It doesn't work in the New Covenant era to do Old Covenant things. It doesn't work now that I'm here and there's redemption. It's like fasting at a wedding. It's like your old restrictions are for the old way. This is a new time, and so the old ways are out of date.
I understand, but in other words, I'll think about it.
No, what was the question again?
What does a worse tear is made? We're tearing the fabric of the old covenant, right?
Yeah. Okay.
With the new, does that mean that because we're making a bigger tear that we're bringing more people into the new covenant?
Oh, I see what you're saying.
Do you know what I'm trying to?
Yeah. I think he's just talking practically there.
I'm thinking literally.
Yeah, yeah. I think he's just talking how practically. Like, there's already a rip in the garment, right? That's why you have the patch in the first place.
Yes.
So he's saying, but to patch up that rip, that tear, you wouldn't take a new piece of cloth. You take an old piece of cloth. Because otherwise, you take a new piece of cloth, the tear that's already there is going to get bigger.
Right. You're
just using practically, the whole point of the parable is don't mix the old with the new.
Okay.
That's it. All and right. So, but here's why. The practical implications in this parable are things rip and they get broken more. Do I see another hand up? Yeah, oh, yes.
So, like, this is
hopefully
not going off what you're wanting to go with here, but. When exactly did the Old Covenant start? At Sinai? And if that was the beginning of it, what was the point of it, like, except for to set apart Israel?
Great question. Okay, so I'm going to nerd out for a minute, but that's okay. I like this question. So I get to talk about covenants, which I'm so happy to do. So what's the first major covenant that you are aware of? Yes?
The Abraham and God.
Yeah, that's what I was going for. Let's talk about Abraham's covenant. Okay, so usually when you have a covenant between God or between two kings or whatever, you have stipulation. You do this. I'll do that. That's our agreement. And we've talked about before that, especially in Abraham's day, what you do after you've cut a covenant, made a covenant, is you'd cut animals in half, and then you'd stick one side of the carcass and one on the, over here and another side over there, and the same thing with like three or four other animals, and then you go arm in arm, maybe not arm in arm, but you take the other king with you, and you walk through the carcasses, like that. And the point of this is, if one of us breaks our agreement, if one of us breaks the covenant, we should be torn in half like these.
And these are going to be crazy naturally. But yes, after you make an agreement, you ratify it.
Right. What better way to ratify it?
It's a little different.
What better way to ratify it than cutting animals in half? I can't think of anything.
Is Abraham before Noah?
Abraham's after Noah. He's,
well, then actually the first covenant was God.
Yes. This, you're right. I shouldn't have said first. This is the first major covenant that we go back to a lot. So what was Abraham's part in the covenant with God?
Sleep.
Huh?
Sleep.
Yeah, right. There, you go back and there's no, Abraham's isn't told to do anything. He trusts in God. God credits him with righteousness. That's it. And then after, this is in Genesis 15, after God reiterates all of his promises, the things he's going to do for Abraham, like make him the father of many nations and bless all the nations of the world through his offspring, then that night, he tells Abraham to cut carcasses up. And so maybe Abraham's expecting to walk through the thing. But that night, God shows up in the image of a fire pot. And he goes through the carcasses alone. Which means this covenant is one that I'm going to fulfill, and you aren't going to have to worry about it. And the great thing about that is that ultimately Abraham's covenant is the one that Jesus fulfills. He fulfills the other one too, but he fulfills as, because he's the seed of Abraham, the offspring of Abraham, by whom all the nations of the earth are blessed. So we're all, when you come to faith in Jesus Christ, this is why Paul says you're made a son or a daughter of Abraham by faith. You're grafted into the family of Abraham. Even if you're Irish or Italian or whatever you might be, it doesn't matter. You're in his family by faith. That's Abrahamic covenant. Along comes the Exodus or the captivity in Egypt, and Moses comes along. God frees them out of captivity, brings them down out to the Red Sea. And then there's the Mosaic Covenant or Sinai Covenant. There are some stipulations here, aren't there? What are the stipulations for Israel?
They have to get circumcised?
Circumcision was brought in here. Okay. Interesting. But yes, they have to be circumcised on the eighth day, just like the rest. Huh? The Ten Commandments come in. Yeah, there's. That's where God gives the law. He gives the moral law, which is don't lie, don't cheat, don't commit adultery, all those things. But there's also the ritual laws come in there that don't eat dead things, and also the civil laws. If you do commit adultery, here's what happens. This is the civil law. Tells you what the consequences are for breaking the moral law or the ceremonial law. So Israel has to follow the law. Now there's a big hint in the Mosaic Covenant that God knows they're not going to be able to follow the law. What's the big hint?
Because he says, and then when you break it.
There you go. He gives them the tabernacle with the sacrifices and the priesthood and all that. So even here in this covenant that God gives, which requires Israel to follow the law, there's also the gospel. There's also the reality that blood has to be shed for you guys because you're not going to make it.
Because the law was never meant to save them, even during the time of the Old Covenant.
Bingo. That's exactly right. Native. I think the point of this law, and that's a long way to get to the answer to your question, I'm sorry. But the point of this law, one of the main points of this law, was to show by effort on the part of the Israelite, trying and trying again to follow the law, that he can't follow the law. And so if he's gonna be justified, he's gotta wait for the seed of Abraham to come. He needs the seed of Abraham. He needs the one who's going to be a blessing to all the nations. He needs to be justified by faith, like Abraham was, not by works of the law. Of course, they don't get that though, right? especially by Jesus's day. Oh no, it is by this. We need to follow this, and that's how we're acceptable within the divine framework.
But Jesus himself was. He did follow the law.
Yes, he did.
Because it had to be perfect. I still get
Okay, so so the this law was intended to, again, humble you, make you recognize you need a sacrifice. At the same time, the prophets are screaming at you, oh no, the bulls and the goats and the sheep, they can't, they aren't going to be able to do what you need them to do. So wait for another. That's one function of it. But also, if you look at the different feasts of Israel, they all point to Jesus, don't they? The Passover, the Feast of Tabernacles, they all point to a Christ. And in fact, Jesus's death coming right on either the day of or the, you know, it's debate about exactly when the Passover, it's a Passover sacrifice. And then his rising is on the day of first fruits. Yeah, so those feasts are set up by God so long ago just for that purpose of pointing to Jesus. And Jesus, the night before he dies, takes the bread and the wine, remember, and he says, this is my body and this is my blood. He takes the elements that are used in the Jewish Passover feast and he reorients them around himself. Because a new time has come, the final sacrifice has been given, a new priest is here. There's all those things were like signposts pointing to your need for me, the moral law, and pointing to what my task will be when I come. I'm going to be your bread. I'm going to be your wine. I'm going to be living with you, like in a tabernacle feast. All those, everything just pointed directly to Jesus. So now Jesus comes, right? He fulfills all the law. He fulfills all the prophets. He does all the things that Israel has been waiting for. And I think Jesus' point in these parables is that the Mosaic covenant is fulfilled. Not that you don't, not that the moral law which God gives there is abrogated. Those are based on his character and nature. But the restrictions surrounding the tabernacle, the cleanliness restrictions, why would you follow those if Jesus, why would you need to follow those? You can't, if you're free to. But why would you need to follow those if Jesus has made you free? And in fact, if you're following them, if you're following the purity regulations in order to be clean, I think Paul would say, if you're to a Jew who's doing that to be made clean, don't do it for that reason. You can do it as a practice, if it's helpful for you, but you have been made clean by Jesus. So the function of those dietary laws, which was to point toward my cleaning, has been fulfilled. So don't go back to the old thing. The author of Hebrews is big on that in the book of Hebrews. So don't. You don't need any more sacrifices because you had the one sacrifice. If you go back to the other sacrifices, you're kind of saying this sacrifice isn't enough. Does that make sense? So again, Paul says that this was kind of given as a tutor for us to learn about the coming, about why we need him, and who he's going to be when he comes, Jesus. So that the Abrahamic covenant is the one that I think the new covenant has brought into full flower, because it's something that is the new covenant is also a covenant in which you are not required to work in order to enter into or maintain, which God has fulfilled all of the requirements himself in Jesus Christ, and then he has now become the blessing for all the nations of the world, Jew and Gentile. That makes it still a little bit. Are you sure? Okay. Well, if you're still confused, I'm sorry. I'll do my best to unconfuse. If I've confused anyone else, I'll do my best to unconfuse you as well. Yes.
Since you just said what you just said, I'm going to ask a kind of a tricky question. My brother has been asking me. He's going through some Old Testament stuff at his church in Michigan, and he's been asking, are we bound by the Ten Commandments in some way as believers? And he's been arguing, no, we haven't.
We're free from the Ten Commandments.
There's still a moral right and wrong, but we're not bound to the any kind of way. And so I'm just curious, in what way, if at all, the moral, or at least the Ten Commandments or anything like that, binds Christians, or if it doesn't at all in the New Covenant. I'm just curious what...
Well, yeah, one way to answer that is to look at how the apostles treat the moral law and how Jesus treats the moral law. Like Paul, he's very clearly operating as if the moral restrictions of the Old Covenant are still in play for Christians. That's why he talks about homosexuality being a sin. That's why he talks about and if you read the moral sections of Paul's letters, you can see he's pulling those Old Testament laws back into a New Covenant framework and applying them to people. So I think we're still under the obligation to obey the laws that God has given that are moral. Of course, we obey them because we're children, not to be made children. Right, so we're in the house, we obey the Father because he's brought us into his house, not in order to get into the house. So there's a huge distinction there. But yeah, so I think those are still binding on Christians. And that's also because the law is not arbitrary. God doesn't just say, sometimes when you're a parent and your kid's running around and just bothering you, you like might take a piece of paper, like, no running. In the hall, you're supposed to put that up in the refrigerator, right? Because you're mad at your kid. So, but God doesn't do that. All of his laws flow from his character, his holiness, right? You don't commit adultery because he's faithful. You don't murder because he's just. You don't lie because he's the truth. There's not really a way that those laws, because they're reflective of his eternal nature, could ever fade away. They're bound up in the structure of the universe. Yes?
I think the one that really throws a lot of modern American Christians off is any kind of Sabbath stuff, because we see how it was abused by the Pharisees in the first century.
Yeah.
So we're like, well, none of that applies. But it does feel to me like we've kind of thrown the baby out with the bathwater.
Well, I think...
That's a lot of thought, but I'm just curious.
Okay, well, several things I think Jesus did with the Sabbath. And the first, what is take away the burden of the Sabbath. He made it. He said the Sabbath is made for man, not man for the Sabbath, and he's Lord of the Sabbath. So I think he intends for it to be a joyful day rather than a day of
gloom.
Yeah, I think I told the story about my grandmother had the Sabbath toys when she was little, and the Sabbath toy. They were very strict Sabbatarians, and so you weren't allowed to play with your normal toys on the Sabbath, which for them was Sunday. You could only play with the paper toys because they didn't make any noise. So you have little paper cutout dolls, paper cutout things, and my grandmother hated them, right? She couldn't stand the Sabbath toys. And so the Sabbath to her was just, oh no, it's Sunday. And I don't want my kids ever thinking, oh no, it's Sunday. So I do think they're taking into account that Jesus wants it to be a day of celebration and feasting. It helps us. Second, the apostles, it does seem, and I'm not going to die on this hill, but it does seem that already in the first century, you have Sunday being the day that has become the fulfillment of the Sabbath. Paul says, "Hey, when you are gathered together, this is 1 Corinthians 16. When you are gathered together on the first day of the week, that's when you take your collection." There's a lot of debate about whether they were also celebrating this or observing the Sabbath, and then they also came together on Sunday. I don't know the answer to that question, but I do think that my personal belief is that the apostles, with the authority of Jesus, has made Sunday the day of celebration of his resurrection. We might call it our Sabbath, our day of rest with him, because that's the day that he gave us rest at the resurrection. That's not to say, like, there are people I know, Christians I know, who like to, who observe Jewish customs and observe that Sabbath as a day of Sabbath. As long as you're not And it, this goes back to the reasoning behind it. As long as you're not saying the old covenant is still in part in play, and we've got to do this as a matter of salvation, then that's fine. But I take Sunday as the new covenant Sabbath day.
I'm sure that like as the early Christians were reading these gospel accounts and thinking through the meaning of the new covenant, they had to very quickly try and figure out how do we practically outwork it.
Yeah.
And I mean, it was obviously a point of huge contention.
I think it early
in Galatians, for example, like Peter and Paul.
I think this goes all the way back to the second century, but the Jesus staying in the tomb on Saturday, before Sunday, some of the fathers, many of the fathers taught that that was his fulfillment of his day of the Sabbath rest. Like his lying in the tomb on the Sabbath fulfilled that particular.
That Jesus is the Sabbath rest.
Right. And his rising.
And
yeah.
We simply acknowledge and celebrate that, and there's no further practical outworking in our own life because he is fulfilled.
Well, except for the Sunday being a day of feasting for the resurrection and celebration of that and setting that apart as the day of the Lord. It's called the Lord's Day in Revelation 2. So it's
even seeing Jesus as the fulfillment, they still set Sunday aside as a Christian Sabbath.
Yeah, but Sabbath as rest and celebration, not Sabbath as with the burden of the old way of looking at it. Yeah.
It's a cheeky answer to Josh's question, but like, you know, when you go back and look at the New Testament writings, you know, which one of the commandments is Jesus okay to be breaking? When you look at the New Testament scripture, like Jesus even goes out of his way sometimes and says like, oh, you've heard it said, don't commit adultery, but if you hate someone with your own heart, you are not.
Don't murder.
In a lot of cases. In the New Testament, he takes the original commandments and actually doubles down on them.
Yeah, yeah.
And then the second part I wanted to say was it's frustrating for modern Christians to not see the Old Testament as being like, oh, well, we're done with that because Jesus sacrificed for us. When it's really the sacrifice. I think you've been using the word ceremonial law. Fulfills the ceremony, fulfills that side of things. But it's not like, oh, well, now that we're free, we're free now to go sin so that glory can be more back.
Right.
So it's just kind of a funny, it's a funny position. Like,
yeah.
Oh, well, now I can drop these things.
I mean, you're right. He has fulfilled the moral law in the sense that he's accomplished it so that our failure to accomplish it doesn't harm us, right? But he hasn't fulfilled it in the sense of putting it to an end. It's there. So yeah, it's a good point. And it's also a good point that he does amp up the. I mean, no one in his day was thinking, oh, if I have these thoughts in my head, I'm committing adultery or I'm murdering somebody. No one was thinking that. And so he, and then in the same sermon to say, well, if your righteousness doesn't exceed that of the Pharisees, you're not. What? oh yes.
And Joe, like the difference in mindset that I think is being identified here is whether or not you see the new covenant as just like coming in and obliterating the old covenant, or the new covenant as a fulfillment of the old covenant. And if it is a fulfillment of the old covenant, then there is so much more intellectual burden on 21st century Christians in the United States to then learn a whole history, culture.
Right.
You know, set of scriptures and like even teachings around, like it's a obviously God calls us to different levels of like intellectual, you know, ascent to his teachings, and you can you don't have to know everything to be saved,
right.
But for many of us, like that does enrich our faith, and like for many of us, like you just being in this room and being literate is historically just like unheard of that you would have so many people with like infinite access to information in the room. Yeah. And so, like, you know, there's like that uplifting burden of being like, okay, well, I have to actually take, you know, if I claim that the new covenant fulfills the old covenant, then I have to actually bother to read all those seemingly more boring books and like learn about, you know, the traditions and, you know, both the ceremonial and the moral laws, and understand how we're seeing these constant reflections of how, you know, God spirals back to these things. And, you know, the first pass, it's broken. and then the next pass, like, he actually kills it. And then even, you know, doubles down and takes it farther and farther. And so he becomes this whole further up and further in that, like, Lewis writes about. And it's, you know, we'll never reach the end of it, but it's so rich and beautiful. And it's like, so amazing that, you know, again, like, to be able to read these things and learn these things, like, is incredible. And I don't even think that, like, I'm objectively, you know, smart in our society. And I get to enjoy and feast on these things and let that, you know, deepen my own faith.
No, I think you're absolutely right. Speaking about communion again, I mean, you can get what you need to get out of the New Testament about it, but understanding the Old Testament depth that's there in Jesus taking that bread and saying, this is my body and this is my blood, it's mind-blowing when you know the Old Testament background. It must have been mind-blowing to his disciples. Did you have to hit it?
Well, I was just going to say, like, you know, our time in Israel and having spent time around Jewish believers, and kind of learning, like, this deeper, richer thing, because Jesus himself was Jewish, has been just so meaningful to us, because I feel like I know Jesus better.
Right. And I think that's a really great point, especially when Jews become Christians, you see a very different experience of conversion than when an Irish person does, because they've been living in the Old Covenant, and they see it, they know it intimately in a way that I don't, and then to see it fulfilled, and that's why I think they're loathe, and I don't think they should have to give up some of the practices that they have, because it's so imbued with meaning now in a way that it wasn't a new meaning than it was before. So
a different plane that probably Jewish person would understand the role of the moral law today, but Martin Luther has a really nice essay on the law, the moral law, as a useful, first of all, for conviction and to teach us that we can attain salvation. And obviously, he's where we look for things like, you know, justification by faith alone. And so once you've got that, like, solidly established, you can also appreciate the law as, this is his analogy, a kind of scaffolding for sanctification. And so a basic structure to learn how to live in a way that's fulfilling God's plan for a human being.
Yeah.
And so holiness is not something that goes away, even for, like, as we learn sanctification, the law is that structure.
Right.
That's his sort of picture of how the law sort of dovetails with justification. Even if not how we earn our salvation. Of course, I think we can trust Martin Luther's, you know, solid on that point.
Yes.
But he still thinks there's a real value to the moral law.
Absolutely. I mean, since the law is a reflection of God's own character and nature, and since he's made us in his image, of course, living by and according to the law is the best way to live. This is where the Proverbs come in, and the Proverbs tell you, you know, if you're not a fool and you're not a drunkard, you're gonna have a happier life than you would if you were otherwise. It stands to reason. So absolutely, law is good, and Paul makes a point of that over and over again. Even when he says things like the curse of the law, but he doesn't think the law is bad at all. So, real quick, just three. I know you probably heard of it before, but there are classically, anyway, three uses of the law. The first use is to drive you to Jesus, because you try, and this is C.S. Lewis says, you try to get up every morning and say, I'm going to be a good person today, I'm going to follow all the laws that God gives me. And like, you know, a minute later, 2 minutes later, you're already having bad thoughts go through your head, and you fail. And you try that day after day after day, and you realize I can't do it. That drives you to the cross, and that's you trust in Jesus, and you're forgiven. So that's the first use of the law, is to show you can't follow the law. But the second use, the third use, people get these. I might not be having the order you've heard. That's okay. The second use is to restrain evil, right? The law. Not only is against murder, for example, is adopted, I think, in every country. I mean, there's lots of arguments about what murder constitutes with the unborn, but at least the idea is out there with people, we shouldn't murder. And that restrains evil. Well, that's the second purpose of God's law, is to restrain the evil of the human heart. The third use is what you're talking about, I think, sanctification. As a guide for our life, as a way of helping us be happy, to be live ordered lives, and not to hurt the people around us, and to not break things and kill people. good, really, really good discussion. I appreciate this. Anyone else have anything to add? Okay, go ahead, Josh.
I've been feeding your questions into Grok.
Grok is good. I'm not liking Grok anymore. It's gonna put me out of a job.
It gives like 6 points, knowing the new government supersedes the old, and incompatibility of legalism with grace. And but I'll just, this final section I thought was kind of interesting. It says, for today, practically this parable challenges us to examine where we might be patching new cloth onto old garments in our own lives, relying on outdated mindsets, legalistic habits, or traditions that don't align with the freedom and fullness of the gospel. It calls us to live in the reality of the new covenant, trusting Christ's sufficiency and letting his transformative grace shape how we approach God and others. At the same time, it reminds us to respect the old covenant's role in God's story, not as something to return to, but as a foundation that finds its meaning in him. I think that's pretty interesting.
what part do you think is interesting? I mean, I do too.
Particularly that it has the nuance, and earlier it talks about this, of it catches the continuity between the old and
yeah,
the new.
Yeah, yeah. Right.
That this isn't like, and it talks about the cloth, the old cloth, the old garment was something that from the beginning was going to be worn out, but it was pointing to
I like that.
The better one that Christ would bring.
Yeah, yeah, I like that.
And
yeah, it's two cloths, not a one thing and another thing. It's two with the same things. And,
and
you know, the wineskin and the wine, it's the same kind of image. Right. That's a good point.
So it isn't like two completely different things.
Right.
It's God is telling the same story.
That's a great point. Good insight. Thanks to Brock.
Thank you, Brock.
Shane, did I see your hand up? Oh. Yes.
I would just like to say, I think that sounded very good, but as Anne is always pointing out in her column, there's an awful lot of bad theology on the web, and if you use one of those AI things to find new information,
That's true.
Be very careful that it's not...
That's true. But Grok is really, I put in the other day, I promise you I will never do this, but I just went, I've heard of people doing this, I wanted to see if it works. So I put in, give me an Ash Wednesday sermon. And it came out like a pretty good sermon. I was thinking, man, that's not bad. All right. Well, I think we're not out of time. We have a little, any other thoughts? We have like 2 minutes.
We can examine what paper or Sabbath toys we have in our
right. No, okay, I do want to kind of end on that because I want my kids to really think of Sunday as the best day of the week. So since they've been little, while they can't, not free to do bad things on Sunday, but we let them, eat things we wouldn't let them eat during the week. Like they can eat, they could have all sugar they want on Sunday.
It's miserable for us.
But they get to watch, within reason, whatever they wanted to watch. They got to watch movies and stuff like that, and just have a good day. So that I think the way it worked was by the time they got to be teenagers, they. In their minds, church had this kind of golden haze about it. Like, oh, it's Sunday. I can't wait to have all the stuff I want to have today. I guess it could go overboard, and you could just make it a very selfish day. So you got to be careful. So they're going to church, right? They're going to go to church, going to worship God, all that kind of stuff. But you do have a little freedom on Sunday that you don't have normally. is what we did. And so I'll just leave that there. If you want to do that as well, it might work for you. Maybe it won't. And now we're out of time. Terry, would you pray for us? Amen. Thank you. Great discussion. Really appreciate it.